and welcome to Locked On Astros, your daily Astros podcast. Here are your hosts, Eric the Man Heisman and Brett H-Town Wheelhouse Chansey.
We are Locked On Houston Astros, and we hope that you join us for a daily Locked On Astros podcast. My name is Eric Heisman. You can find me on Twitter at Eric Talk Stros. You can find the show at Locked On Astros, your team every day. And I have a special co-host today. You might know him as Brownie. Bill Brown, how you doing, sir? Are you enjoying retirement?
Yes, I am, Eric, and good to chat with you again. It's been a while since we did a show, and it's been kind of a laid-back winter, as you know, people trying to stay out of each other's way.
So where can they find you on Twitter?
At Brownie TW.
All right, guys. So we're going to be talking a little bit about Astros history, what Bill Brown sees for the Astros in 2021. What do you think about the 2020 season? We'll be talking about all this on tonight's Locked On Astros podcast. And don't forget, you can get Locked On Astros on the podcasting app Himalaya, as well as Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. When you get in your car, tell your smart device to pay podcast, Locked On Astros. All right, so I really do want to talk about your book, Sportscasting 101. Before we get too much into the book, I don't think a lot of the young Astros fans know how you even got into the play-by-play.
At age 14, I decided I wanted to be a baseball broadcaster, Eric. It was that simple. I knew I couldn't make it as a player. I was trying, but there were a lot of strikeouts there. There were some missed pop-ups and some flubbed up ground balls. So that made me able to choose at a very young age that I wasn't going to be a player, and as close as I could get was broadcasting. So that's why I chose that.
So how did you go to school for that? And how did you get land a job with the Astros? Or were you somewhere before?
Yeah, I did go to school for that. I went to Missouri Journalism School and came out of there and got a job in San Antonio. But I wasn't doing sports there. I was a news reporter. At that point, you know, you had to work your way up. So there wasn't an opening in the sports department. Then I got drafted, went into the Army. After that, went to Cincinnati, started working for the NBC affiliate there. Got a chance to eventually work my way into doing the Cincinnati Reds games on TV and did that for 7 years. Then I got fired there, bounced around for 5 years, and came to Houston.
Who fires Bill Brown? Come on.
Well, it was, it was an interesting situation, and I learned quite a bit from it. I think, like most people will tell you, when they fail, they wind up better for it. I was able to learn some things that I was not doing at that time and put them into play when I got to Houston. I had a 5-year hiatus away from baseball. I was doing general sportscasting shows, but not doing baseball games. So I really missed that. And I had a hunger to get back in. But as you know, once you fall off the merry-go-round and try to get back into baseball, that's very difficult. So I was extremely fortunate to get the opportunity here. And I think I was a little bit different when I came to Houston than when I left Cincinnati. I would hope anyway that I had learned some things that I was able to put into practice. And it probably, in the long haul, was beneficial for me to get fired.
Yeah, I think even AJ Hinch, when he came to the Astros, he said he actually was glad that he got fired from the Diamondbacks because he learned a lot from that situation and it made him become a better manager. I know the situation, how the situation turned out, but he's back in managing with the Tigers. We can talk about that a little bit later, but back to your book, Sportscasting 101. Why did you do this? Did you just, are you trying to help the future generation or you're just like, you know what? I have all this knowledge. Let me just put it on a book.
I think your first question was where I would go with that one, because here I am at the end of the trail, looking back now and thinking, boy, you know, I had a really good high school journalism teacher and I didn't properly thank him for everything he did in that class. And then, of course, a lot of good teachers in college. And beyond that, just professionals who worked with me along the way. And, many of them are gone now, so it's impossible to go back and thank them. But One thing it is possible to do is to help the next generation. And I've actually, as a byproduct of the book, the Bridgeland High School journalism teacher, Samantha Berry, has worked on redesigning the text in the book to make it more streamlined, more readable, so it looks a lot better now than when it first came out. And she asked me if I would mentor one of her students. And Tommy Yarish is a senior there at Bridgeland and wants to get into play-by-play. So he's in the process of selecting which college he's going to now. And all this is covered in the book. It's covered by people like Brad Sham of the Dallas Cowboys and, you know, all the Houston broadcasters that Houston viewers and listeners would know. And then some from out of town and other parts of the state as well. They all tell their life stories, how they selected a college, whether it was a good or bad selection, what they learned there, how they put it into play after college, and how they got to where they are now. So I think in reading all these life stories, a senior in high school or a junior in college or somebody who's in the first or second year in the play-by-play business can gain something from that.
So I'm assuming over time you've had to kind of grow on your own because they didn't have Twitter back when you started going. Now you have Instagram and everything that you have to do to stay relevant. How have you been learning kind of the social media aspect of things?
Well, I remember Allison Footer came to me years ago and said, well, you need to get on Twitter. I said, really? And she said, yeah. And she was right. So she showed me how to get on. So she gave me the at Brownie TW handle. I didn't know what to do with that. And she nursed me along. And, you know, the Astros, and I presume all the pro and college sports teams who have broadcasters want them on social media. They want them interacting with people. And I agree, it's a good thing. Sometimes not so much, but in general, it's nice to stay in touch with people, to give them access to us. And it helps us to get a feel for what they're thinking and what they want to know.
So you've been watching a lot of Astros baseball over the years. I mean, outside of the World Series, which era was the most exciting for you to watch? Just like the players and the type of baseball they played.
Well, I'm going to sound like exactly what I am, an old guy and an old timer and an old school guy, but my favorite era was the era of the 70s, even though, you know, the artificial turf part of it and the multi-purpose stadium part of it was not my favorite. But the game itself, there were more 3-2 games. There was more action, doubles, triples, double plays, great fielding plays, because the ball was in play a lot more than it is now with as many strikeouts as we have now. So I think that, you know, the stolen base was very important in that era. And that's what I liked about it, because I think it came down for the fans more to really paying attention to different situations. Okay, the Cardinals were running like crazy with Whitey Ball. Are they going to run on this next pitch? Is there going to be a pitch out? You know, that part of the game is really a very small part of it right now. And so that's why the 70s were my favorite era.
Who was your favorite pitcher, Astros pitcher of all time? Would it be Nolan Ryan or somebody else?
Well, you know, I had so many thoughts when you asked that question. I love Mike Scott and the way he was so dominant. Randy Johnson when he was here for 2 months. Nolan, Roger Clemens, you know, Verlander, the great Hall of Fame guys, of course, are going to be the ones that most fans gravitate toward. And I do too, but I also loved guys like Mike Hampton, you know, just watching him develop into a big winner who had a 22-4 season 1 year and could do everything. He could field, he could hit, he could run. It was fun to watch him too. So I guess it's hard for me to narrow that down. There have been a lot of them. And Billy Wagner, I enjoyed watching him close games too.
Yeah, Shane Reynolds was always one of those guys. I just kind of respected how he went about his game, and he didn't throw the hardest, but he just knew how to pitch. And so there's been a lot. Jose Lima was another good one, but Roger Clemens coming through Houston, that was awesome too. But there's been some great names. I'm going to take a second to talk about Built Bar. Built Bar is a protein bar that tastes like a candy bar. There's 16 amazing flavors. There's a whole bunch of more flavors out for the holiday season. Why don't you go out and get a Built Bar? Built Bar is something you can eat on your way to work, or if you're a teacher and lunch is too early, like my lunch is, maybe around 6 or 7 p.m. I'm like, I want a Built Bar. Built Bars are covered in 100% chocolate. They're soft and easy to choose. And Built Bars are healthy. It's better than the popcorn and butter I just ate a little while ago. So you can lose or maintain weight while indulging in a delicious treat. Bars are low calorie, low sugary, sugar, low, high protein, high fiber. Zero. Let's talk about my favorite, which is the orange chocolate cream. It's 15 grams of protein, 110 calories, 3 grams of sugar, 4 grams of net carbs, and Brett's, I think, is the one of his favorites is the mint brownie. It's the same thing. It has 110 calories, 4 grams of sugar, 5 grams of net carbs. So if you just want a snack, but you don't want to eat anything that's going to really make you regret it later on, why don't you go to Built Bar and go to BuiltBar.com. Use the promo code LOCKEDON and you get $10 off your first order. Use the promo code LOCKEDON for $10 at BuiltBar.com. And I do hear that Santa does also put Built Bars in your stockings. I think Garrett Cole was probably the most dominant of the modern era. Let's not go back into the old days, but just looking back at the 2017 World Series, I don't know if we talked since that happened. What were you thinking when the Astros finally won the World Series?
I was just so relieved after all the playoff failures, and I was at home watching with my wife, and we just got up and hugged after the game. But I was writing a book after that season, and what I enjoyed was hearing the thoughts of people who have been around longer than I have, like Larry Durker and Tal Smith, and getting their thoughts about it. I just think that after all the playoff failures, to have a team that finally closed the deal was so meaningful. And, you know, the 05 World Series was memorable in that finally the team reached it, but the World Series itself, not very memorable.
Was the offense as bad as I remember going into that?
It was pretty bad. Yeah.
I just remember, I'm like, how did we get this far? Oh my gosh, we're facing the White Sox. And I was able on Talking Stros to kind of curse Jeff Blum out one time, and he had some fun with that, but but it was all in good fun. But yeah, all the World Series were great. I think that 05 was kind of different just because of that, what happened earlier in the season with the Tombstone and everything that happened to lead up to that. So now that the Astros did win the World Series, and we did get that report at the end after this world or the 2019 World Series about the trash can scandal. I don't want to talk too much about this today, but I just wanted to just hear your thoughts about that in general.
I don't know any more than anybody else who's been reading the reports knows about it. Certainly didn't have any hint that it was going on when it was going on. Obviously, I think, you know, to have a tainted title like that because of the cheating is something that no Houston fan likes to hear about and does hear about frequently, especially on Twitter. But from everything we've read, from the factual presentation of the commissioner's report, it did happen. And for that, I'm sad because I think, you know, that it should have been the crowning achievement and the moment everybody wants to remember. And now it's almost as if I think so many fans just want another one just for the fact that they want this to be one without cheating. Would they have won it anyway? It's possible. Were other teams doing things like they were doing? Quite possible. And I don't think there was a full-fledged investigation into other teams either. I think there was a desire to find a team that could be punished, and that's exactly what happened. But I think the game needed to be cleaned up in terms of that, and I think it has been. I feel bad for some of the players who were accused of doing things as far as cheating, and they really didn't engage themselves in it much at all, if at all. So, you know, there are a lot of different layers to this thing, Eric. I think it's probably going to take even more time and even more people writing books and even more years passing by before the guys who were involved become retired and really start talking about it. It's very hard to analyze it right now, but I'm just sad that it happened.
I'm glad the Dodgers won this year so they can finally get it off their back. But every time the Astros go to LA or Anaheim, any team kind of in the area, when the fans are allowed to return to the parks, it's not going to be pretty. So I know you're an old school guy. What were your thoughts of Dusty Baker as a manager in 2020? Is he still the same guy, or do you think he's made some adjustments?
I think he's adapted to the times. I think he's in tune with today's players. I don't think they see him as a guy who's been passed by the game. I think they enjoy his company. And we were doing some interviews today, Steve Sparks and I, for Astroline with a couple of their relievers. And they were extremely complimentary about the way Dusty gave them confidence to go out and do what they did. Brooks Raley was one and Andre Scrub was the other. And they both could not have been more complimentary about Dusty and playing for him. So obviously he brought out the best in his players. It took a while. It was a very substandard regular season, but just a weird year. But he saved the year with what his team did in the postseason. And for that, he deserves a lot of credit, because there were many people who just didn't think the Astros should even be in the playoffs.
Yeah, and definitely after, especially I think the Astros were the second team in history to finish a season with a losing record and make the playoffs. The other one was, I believe, the Brewers this year as well. So it's just kind of like the Astros have all these dubious records. But yeah, Dusty Baker, I think that he gets a lot of criticism. Some of it may be warranted, but every manager has their things that people criticize, and that's their job. And that's why the Astros brought him in, was to kind of hamper all the storm of the fallout from what Mike Fiers had to say, everything. But looking at the playoffs, the 2020 playoffs, were you surprised the Astros got as hot as they did?
Very much so. I did not see that coming at all. When they swept the Twins, I was pleasantly surprised enough to feel that, okay, they made something out of this season after all, no matter what they do next. And then, the challenges that were presented in those next two series were substantial. And so I think beating Oakland to me was just a major achievement, because the A's just dominated them all season long. And their hitters just came alive. And this is what I think made it difficult for Dusty. Virtually every hitter on that team did not play up to the back of his baseball card. The numbers were, you had guys who 290 career hitters hitting 240. And yet almost all of them came alive at the same time in the playoffs. Very unlikely that would happen. But in a 60 game season, we figured we would be shocked by a lot of things, and we certainly were.
So looking at Jose Altuve's yips defensively, have you ever covered a team that had a player that kind of struggled with a defense like that?
No, I haven't covered a team, but I remember, of course, Steve Sachs with the Dodgers having those problems. Chuck Knobloch, when he was playing second base, had those problems. I remember a catcher named Mackie Sasser, who really had to walk about halfway to the mound because he couldn't even throw the ball back to the pitcher. And I read some articles about these, and it's just something mental. Steve Sachs talked about it when he was on the MLB Network. And this is right about the time Altuve was going through this. And Sachs felt that it would take some time. He felt that maybe next year he'd be able to get through it. He had no idea he'd be able to kind of work his way through it during the playoffs in 2020. But it's some kind of a mental block. Often it's triggered by an injury to the shoulder, as far as the catchers quite often are concerned. It might be a foul ball they take off the top of the shoulder, and they start thinking about how their shoulder's hurting them. And then that negative thought gets in their mind and it affects their throwing. I don't think you could blame it on that if you're a second baseman, but whatever reason, those negative thoughts creep in, and it's a horrible thing to watch, whether he's on your team or somebody else's team. It is just agony to watch a player go through that.
Speaking of negative thoughts, a lot of fans are having some negative thoughts right now about Mr. George Springer possibly leaving the Houston Astros. We're not talking about rumors or anything, but what did George Springer mean to you or to Astros fans in general?
Well, I think if you were fortunate enough, as the media is, to see the clubhouse, be standing in the Astros clubhouse when he walks in to begin the day, you can just see the life that he brings into that clubhouse. And obviously fans can see it on the field and on the bench and in the on-deck circle when he's high-fiving somebody. So that is obvious, his impact on the team. He definitely has an emotional plus side impact on the team. And so if he does move on, that will, you know, somebody is going to have to pick up the slack there. I think it could be Carlos Correa. I think we really saw the coming out party as far as leadership goes of Correa. You know, Altuve is a very encouraging guy, but he's not overt about it like Springer. But it could come from someone else. I think Bregman may grow into that role also. And this is what happens in this era of free agency now. Players move on, teams adjust to it. They have to. That's the way the game is now. And the Jeff Bagwells and Craig Biggios are going to be very hard to find. People who play 20 years, 15 years for a team and only one team. I don't know how many of those we'll see in the future.
So were Jeff Bagwell and Craig Biggio the team leaders in the clubhouse back in the day too? Or were they, I know Bagwell's kind of quiet, but.
Right. They were. Oh. Although I would say that Brad Ausmus was every bit the team leader. And I think if you talked to the players who were there at that time, they would tell you, you know, usually you'd see Bagwell and Ausmus and then Biggio would come over and they'd chat and, you know, maybe Billy Spires would be involved in that conversation as well. So I think it was a collective team effort that they would, you know, compare notes about this, that, and the other thing. And, I can tell you one story, Hunter Pence. I don't know if it was his rookie year or his, I think he came up in June, maybe it was his first full season the next year. He one time after a game was keeping the media waiting in his locker while he was in the food room grabbing a bite to eat after the game. And one of those guys you mentioned quietly came up to him after the game and after all the media left the room and said, "Don't keep the media waiting. Eat after they leave." And just little things like this, you know, this is how you act when you're a professional. And if it's a Jeff Bagwell who tells somebody that or a Brad Ausmus, I think quite often it was Brad who actually verbalized to whoever it was, the culprit of whatever it was that was done wrong. But it didn't really matter because it was a well-discussed comment that was talked about before it was actually relayed to the player in question. So I would say it was a group effort.
Yeah, looking at Zach Greinke, I know he's a very different individual, but what is it like kind of watching him, like kind of get more comfortable in Houston, and he gets to show who he really is. So what do you think about Zach Greinke being on the Astros?
I really enjoy watching him perform. I don't think I would enjoy covering him if I were in the media because he doesn't really talk much. Although he, you know, from time to time, he has his moments. He makes fun of himself. I actually think he really has a good personality, but it takes a little cracking through that barrier, that block of ice that's in front of him. And I do believe that, you know, he's battled with a social disorder. I think that's been written quite a bit down through the years. So you have to allow for that. We're not all cut from the same cloth. And I think that Houston is a great place for him because Houston is not a high pressure media market and people can be who they are. They don't want to talk to the media. that's usually not going to put them in terrible stead with the writers the way it would in a, we'll say, a New York or a Philadelphia or another high pressure market. But what I enjoy is aside from all that, just watching him pitch and watching how creative he is and how innovative he is. And, you know, the one game when he mouthed the pitch, you know, to Maldonado that he was going to throw, you could read his lips and everybody in the ballpark could see what he told him, but he threw it anyway. Of course, you know, you put yourself in the mindset of the hitter. And if the hitter had been watching, and I don't think he was at that time, he might have seen him say slider or whatever it was to Maldonado. But now, am I going to believe what he's telling him, or is he decoying me? So it's not automatic, right? But no, I think he's I love to watch pitchers like Greinke. You mentioned Shane Reynolds earlier. Not the high 90s throwers, but they do it with their heads and their bodies, both. And I think those are the most enjoyable types to watch.
I saw him one time at a playoff game, and I think he was surprised that somebody recognized him. But he's a tall dude.
Yeah. No, I think he's probably a very nice guy. I think he's been good with the young pitchers on the team. They've talked about that. And he's been a real asset. And, you know, big things are going to be expected of him in 2021.
All right. So the final question I have for you is, what is your favorite call as Astros announcer or a commenter?
Well, I always revert to the default Craig Biggio 3000th hit. And I think that probably would be it, but, you know, I mean, that would be the one that most people would expect me to say. So I'm going to say it. But there were probably some others that weren't, you know, game winning situations or something. And that's what it seems to come down to for a lot of people, but, you know, maybe somebody made a great catch and robbed a home run. And like, remember when Springer, robbed that home run in Arlington against the Rangers. And, I think it was a grand slam. He went way up over the right field wall, and that was that was a game-saving catch. But it wasn't in the ninth inning, as I recall. It was earlier than that. So that could be the play of a game, of any game. And usually if somebody has a good call on a play like that, then he might feel to himself that that was a better call than a home run that wins a game.
So you kind of brought up with the Sportscasting 101 book. How would you, like when that Craig Biggio moment came up, did you kind of rehearse what you were going to do, or do you just rely on the moment for what you're going to say?
Well, I have a story for you if you have time, or are we at the end of our time?
No, okay. We got plenty of time.
So about 2 weeks before that game, the Astros were in Denver, and I had lunch with my Colorado Rockies play-by-play buddy, Wayne Hagen, who was doing their radio play-by-play. And he said, well, what are you going to be saying when Biggio gets his 3,000th hit? I said, well, I really don't know, and I don't think that you can write something down or rehearse it. It just doesn't come off as sincere. I think, you know, the way to do that is just go with the moment. He said, well, I think you might want to think about that a little bit more, because think about the history of this team. And, you know, you've never had a moment like this in the history of this team with a player doing what he's about to do. And that call is going to be preserved for a long time. So you really have to get this right. And so he kind of put the pressure on me. But I started thinking about it, and I decided, yeah, I think he's right and I'm wrong. So I need to come up with something here. And so for about 2 weeks every day, I tried to come up with a line with something from Craig's past or something from Astros history. And I was just coming up empty. I had nothing, absolutely nothing. So we came home from Milwaukee, which was the final game of the road trip. And first game back home is when he got number 3,000, as you recall. And so I was pulling in the garage about midnight or something after getting home from a road trip, and something came to me, and I went inside the house and I wrote it down before I brought my luggage in into the house from the car. And I just wrote it down. And it was a line that I kind of tagged on after the hit had already happened, after he had been mobbed at second base, and the excitement was starting to die down a little bit, but something to the effect of, years ago, he came from the small town of Smithtown, New York. And now at some point in the future, he's going to be heading for a small town of Cooperstown, New York to join those in the Hall of Fame. So that was about it. I don't think many people took note of it, but that was my line. And that was my line to sort of try to stamp this as a signal achievement, something that hadn't been done before, something that needed to be stamped and put aside. But for the game call itself, no, I don't think you can do that for the game call itself. And I didn't like my call of the hit that much anyway, because I got too excited and I kind of lapsed into a radio play-by-play description of, you know, line drive to right center field. Well, everybody can see that. That's not the kind of call that you're proud of on TV, but you just get overcome with emotion. And so that's the reason I was glad I did write that one line in my scorebook, and I put it on a piece of paper in the back of my scorebook. So, you know, about a minute after he's standing on second base, I pull that out, and hey, I'm the only one who noticed it, but at least I paid homage to what Wayne Hagen wanted me to do.
Yeah, so you did a good job there, and I just love that story, just how you you kind of addressed it, and you're like, yeah, this is I kind of did it partially in a moment, but I had this rehearsed, and that's awesome. And were you able to go to Cooperstown when Biggio went in?
Actually, I was. The Astros invited me to go on their charter, and for Bagwell also. So those were
okay.
two of my big thrills.
Yeah, I was up there in Cooperstown for Bagwell. I got to meet Larry Durker, Jose Cruz Sr., and Tal Smith. Like, I ran into him outside of the museum. I took a picture with him, and I'm like, oh, hey, Tal Smith. So Sportscasting 101, where can they find a book, and where can they find you again on Twitter?
It's on Amazon.com. We have a website for the book, and it's sportscasting101.com. So if you're just wanting to check it out, you don't know if you want to buy it or not, you can see everything you need to see about the book on sportscasting101.com. It's got a list of all the people in the book, and they're people from all the different team play-by-play sports. So if you want to go into soccer, you'll get some advice from Glenn Davis of the Houston Dynamo, blah, blah, blah. I'm at BrownieTW and on Twitter, and enjoy interacting with the fans there.
Well, I'm 42. Am I, should I get the book and try to get into sportscasting, or?
You know, I would say that there are two guys who started in their 40s, and they've both done high school and a lot of high school sports, and they're on YouTube. So, you know, hey, nationwide TV, right?
Right.
You're available anywhere. But I think that if you're a sports fan and you enjoy what broadcasters do, or you're curious about how they do what they do, they explain it. You know, we've got pictures of spotting boards that guys use for football and score sheets for basketball and how they use that. If you're into that kind of thing, I think you'll enjoy it. If you're not, I would say don't buy the book.
Alrighty. Well, that's Bill Brown. You may have grown up watching him on TV. I really thank you for taking the time to come on this podcast, and hopefully the 2021 season will bring another World Series so we can win it without the trash cans, and the legacy will be fulfilled or whatever. So thanks for joining us. You got anything else you want to say?
Nope. Thank you, Eric. Have a good evening.
All righty. So, guys, that's all we got for tonight's Locked On Astros podcast. We'll be back tomorrow. And don't forget, go check out the Locked On MLB podcast, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.